following account is, without too much embellishment, is a story of a hunt, an unusual hunt with a crew of five hunters in the month of September, 65. I received a telephone call and a very inebriated voice on the other end said, we want to go hunting. Well, I said, where are you? And what would you like to hunt? And how many hunters do you have? He said, I think are in Anchorage. And there are five of us. And we want to hunt everything. So I told the party, whose name was Mr. Harry Webb, that we could take care of their hunt, and I would arrive in Anchorage with two aircraft to take care of their five hunters and all their gear, and we would be there in less than an hour. So Mr. Webb was not hard to locate. He's surrounded by four gold stripe airline captains. Had flown a Learjet up from the East Coast. It followed that Harry Webb was quite a wealthy man. He had several shortcomings. One was scotch. He didn't believe in diluting his scotch with ice cubes even. And we loaded up the entire crew in the two six-passenger Cessnas and, complete with their gear, headed northbound. I elected to show the captains the area, and my plan was to have them pick out the location of their choice. So we proceeded into the deep heart of the Iron Mountains. Mountain sheep were much in evidence. This area is about 60 to 70 miles east to southeast of Talkeetna. It's an extremely difficult location to get into. Only by aircraft can you negotiate the Iron Mountains and the Talkeetna range. In the past, there have been horse packing operations, just a few in the area. 40 years ago, Andy Simons used the Rainbow Lake area and the Yellow Jacket and Upper Talkeetna River as his base of operations for his wilderness hunts of Alaska. And this area abounds in giant caribou and all varieties of bears, the black bears, the big Pokot grizzly bears, brown bears. This is great, as I say, great trophy caribou country, and in the lush vegetation of the 3,000-4,000 foot elevations, there are many trophy moose. Also, many fine fur-bearing animals. There's a great population of wolves, wolverines, and smaller fur-bearing animals throughout this Talkeetna watershed. It's a rugged country. It's quite broken. It's the foothills become rougher and steeper until finally you go to the source of the Sheep River, the Iron River, and the Talkeetna River into the Iron River ice cap. Glacier is 11,000 to 13,000 feet high and very extremely rugged going. This has been a trophy sheep area for years, and it's just been within the last 20 years that there's been some sandbars cleared off where you might land a light aircraft or possibly up in the high lakes, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 foot elevation with a floatplane. And as we flew along, I pointed out the trophy rams and the big caribou and the mountain goats were quite in evidence. As I say, it is extremely rough country. Also, we saw 6 or 7 big trophy bears in the brown bear and the grizzly bear class. And they were quite elated that within an hour's flight from Anchorage, they should come into such an exceptional game country. They also noted how rough it was, inaccessible, and it would be extremely difficult to move around in this country. And this is just key to why the game resided in this Talkeetna watershed. It's inaccessible, rough, and remote, even though it's only an hour's flight out of Anchorage. The plan was to begin the hunt at 6 a.m. the following morning. The crew 5 were installed at one of the local motels in Talkeetna, and instead of a 6 o'clock takeoff, it was 4 in the afternoon before we was able to pour the chief, Mr. Webb, into a float plane and head him out to sea to get him up into the trophy caribou country and up in the Iron Mountains. And this was a repeat performance, it would have been, except the following morning, on the 6 o'clock takeoff, we poured Mr. Webb into the plane along with several of his captains, and the hunt continued. We were setting up spike camps up in the high mountains with the float plane at elevations of about 4,000 feet. One of our areas we crossed was in the Jay River, Upper Susitna River area, and lo and behold, there were about 2 dozen trophy class bull caribou crossing and swimming this Upper Susitna River. Now, there's an old ancient trapper's cabin, nearly 70 years old, approximately 200 yards upstream from where the caribou were crossing, an old tumble-down trapper shack. The old trappers used to make a tremendous cleanup since the area is full of prime fox and wolf, wolverine and marten and mink and other types of fine fur animals. During the 1922 to 27 era, there were many trappers of this in the upper Talkeetna watershed, and the price of fur was fabulous. Silver fox, for which this country abounds, were worth in the prime condition up to $500 a piece, which was almost a fortune at the old price of money. Two of the old timers made a good success at trapping in the early days were Elmer Simcoe and his partner Towsley. Now, these two traveled by dog team from Anchorage through the Chicaloon Pass and into the heart of the Iron Mountains. And they had cabins scattered every 20 miles or so throughout the watersheds, up in the Fog Lakes, in the Tocina Butte area, and clear back to the Chicaloon Pass area, which was about 60 miles west, southwest of Sheep Mountain. Anyway, that's the way they got into the country with their big dog teams and their freight sleds. And it is not unusual to see and to get the trophy sheep in excess of 42 inches curl. And the game is much in evidence, as I say, because the hunting pressure due to its remoteness is not a factor there in the middle of the Iron Mountains. As we were flying to the headwaters of the Susitna River, that'd be the north end of the Talkeetna Mountains, we noticed this large herd of bull caribou crossing the big Susitna River. Often they cross from one mountain range to another. Usually they stay in the high glaciers throughout the summer. In the fall they start to move, and they go from one range to another, and often cross watersheds in the process. And one of our camps was to be the old Elmer Simcoe hunting trapping cabin there at Jay River, a branch of the Upper Susitna. So we were quite surprised to see more than a dozen big bull caribou crossing nearly at the cabin. As I say, this is an old ramshackle, tumble-down cabin, about 70 years old. We was to use it as a base camp, and then we'd go from there and hunt sheep in the higher terrain to the north. We landed in a float plane, and Harry, who by this time was admiring the caribou, and without further ado stepped out on the float, the plane still moving. And I say, "Wait, Harry, you'll fall in the river." And he took a flying shot at one of the large bull caribou at about 300 yards. The caribou is moving, the plane is moving. And strangely enough, the caribou fell, rolled clear back to the river. And 380-point double shovel trophy caribou. As I say, Mr. Webb rarely mixed his scotch even with ice cubes, and had, in spite of his congeniality and his good humor, had probably never been truly sober for the last 25 years. Proceeding along on the same adventure on a different day with the same float plane and Mr. Webb and two of his captains aboard, we were landing at a different location high in the Iron Mountains on a lake about 4,500 feet elevation. And there were mountain sheep in evidence, and in his haste to evacuate the airplane at our spike camp on this 4,500-foot lake, this camp had previously been set up about 2 weeks prior to the arrival on this particular day. Mr. Webb bailed out of the airplane into about 10 feet of ice water in the lake. And after he was dried off and got organized why the hunt continued there, anyway, for 2 weeks, the Webb expedition had fabulous luck. They filled the hangar with their limits of caribou, moose, mountain sheep, bears, brown bears, black bears, and finally the day to leave arrived. The four captains said, "Harry, I want to tell you we're going to mutiny on you and abandon you here right in Talkeetna. You've got 20 minutes to get your gear together and go with us, or you'll have to ride northwest back to the East Coast." What they meant, of course, that Harry always dragged his feet and was quite an obstacle to move. So Harry says, "All fellas," he says, "can't we wait just another day or two?" They said, "No, Harry, we've got all our game and we got great trophies and we want to jump in the Learjet and fly back to the East Coast. Our vacation's over and our wives will divorce us and we've had a wonderful time." And as a matter of fact, Harry had a wonderful time. He's probably the only genuine millionaire that ever got thrown out of two of the joints in Talkeetna, once, twice, and once. He was quite a problem to compete with, especially with the ladies. In one occasion, he, after being thrown out of this motel, he decided to come back through the window, and he was met by the irate operator of the motel, who happened to be a lady, and as he got his head through the window, she brought the window down on his neck. But after he was duly extracted from the window, they retired to the bar and patched up their differences. And Harry's fond memories prompts him to call us once every month or so to rehash some of the episodes that took place during the hunt. At the moment, we're concerned, of course, with getting Harry on the Learjet headed back to the East Coast. Harry, of course, is not interested in leaving Talkeetna. He's having a ball here. He likes the people, and he's went fishing and caught all kinds of five varieties of salmon and big rainbow trout and grayling and lake trout and various game fishes that abounds in this area. And he don't think his vacation's quite finished yet, although he does want to fly in the Learjet back to the East Coast. So finally they said, "Okay, Harry, you've got 10 minutes. And we are going to load up a couple of planes, head for Anchorage, jump in the Learjet, and that's it. You'll have to walk back to the East Coast." So Harry said, "Okay, fellas, I'll go." So he came in the house here, and he said to Roberta, my wife, he said, "Hey, we got our bill figured up." And Roberta said, "Well, yes, Mr. Webb. Here's 2 weeks. Each day is separate. And the total's on the back page." And she handed him an itinerary of the guides, the packers, the flight hours flown, the original estimate of the trip for the five hunters. And Harry looked at the back page, the total of all the 2 weeks of the hunting endeavor for the five hunters, and he says, "What day is this for?" He's looking now at the totals for the 2 weeks on the back page, the grand total of the whole hunt. And Roberta said, "Oh, Mr. Webb, that's not a day's total, that's a total for the 2 weeks." So Harry said, "Let's discuss this with another little drink of scotch." So he poured himself a water glass full of scotch and says, "You know something?" He says, "I've only got one check left, and I've already got it made out. And here it is." And he gave it to Roberta, my wife, and Roberta said, "Oh, Mr. Webb, we can't accept a check like that. It's too much." And he says, "Take it or leave it. It's my last check." So I'm looking over Roberta's shoulder, and I say, "We'll take her." So that out of the way, I said, "Harry, now which taxidermist do you want all of these horns and furs and hides sent to?" And he says, "I'm going to give them to your daughter, Blueberry." I say, "Harry, we spent hours caping out the caribou and the moose and doing a precision skinning job on the bears and the mountain sheep and everything. And surely you don't want to leave all these trophies. It was outstanding trophies." He says, "Well, I'll tell you what I need. Those four last caribou we hauled in whole, that are hanging in the meat house, Says, I want to take him back whole. He says, I like fat caribou. I say, well, Harry, you only have 10 minutes and your crew's ready to go. Let's just take two of the caribou and it'll take me a few minutes to cut them up. He says, you got them in here whole as hollum whole. I said, yeah, but Harry, you have to take all the seats out of the airplane and it's quite a struggle to get the plane loaded with the whole caribous. Well, he said, yeah, I said he knew that, but he wanted them like that anyway. And I said, yeah, but Harry, when you get them to the Learjet, you propose to just skid these big bloody caribou into the Learjet, that executive Learjet? And Harry looked kind of startled for a minute, and he said, ha, he says, well, he had an answer for everything. He says, blood's red, and upholstery is purple, and he says, if the executive jet squawks, he says, I'll just have the Learjet it reupholstered. The next episode will be a true story. An event that took place in about 1955, and it involved an aircraft crash and an excellent fishing expedition. Short distance to the east of Talkeetna, which is in the center of some of the greatest fishing of Alaska, are many headwater streams where the mighty runs of salmon and the multiple runs of various varieties of salmon come in from the salt water and spawn and make a one-way trip into the sandy, suitable spawning grounds. Hordes of game fish, such as the rainbow trout, which often run in the 7-8 pound class in this area, and the sea run Dolly Varden, and the grayling and the other game fish, follow the salmon to these headwaters, and they do their very best to eat up all the eggs as they're laid and all the spawn as they're hatched, and in the process they become quite fat and sassy. That is, with the great nutrients of the salt water and the great quantities of the spawn in the area and the tremendous millions of tons of salmon, this is conducive to a great fishing area. Primarily then, the sport fish is predicated on the tremendous amount of 5 or 6 runs of salmon that come in from salt water to these headwaters to spawn. Such location is 6 miles east of Talkeetna, Chunelna Clear Creek location. Many of the fishermen from all around charter out float planes and airboats and go into these headwaters for the fine fishing that abounds there. This particular aircraft flew in from Fairbanks. There were three aboard. The owner of the aircraft and his friend and the proprietor of the City Hotel of Fairbanks. A great, tremendous hulk of a jolly lady. An Irish gal. She weighed about 285 on the hoof and was an ardent rainbow fisherman. They spent considerable time at Chunelna Clear Creek, and they ran out of space, so they decided to put the fish in the floats, which seemed like a good idea. So after filling several compartments full of rainbow trout, the aircraft attempted to take off. And this is late evening, about 1957. A mile or two of river was used on the attempt to take off. And at this point, the aircraft slowed and negotiated a 90-degree turn, and then continued to take off downstream another 2 miles. Well, normally, a float plane is either going to fly or not going to fly in about the first 20 seconds or so, if you can get the plane up on the step and coax it into the air from that relative position why you're in business. But obviously the plane was overloaded with the passengers and the floats full of fish. So the takeoff attempt continued downstream 4 more miles, where an impossible switchback turn was negotiated. The aircraft did raise into the air, crashed over the point of this 180-degree switchback turn into a big pile of stumps, continued on into the river. The Talkeetna River at that location is about 150 feet wide and running quite swiftly, and the wreckage skittered into the center of the Talkeetna River beyond the switchback turn as it tripped over the stump pile en route. So the pilot of the aircraft swam to the south shore and was uncertain as to the final outcome of the other two passengers. Obviously, the plane was a total wreck. So it was about 3 o'clock in the morning that I flew in a pitch black night to the old CAA 4,000 foot runway, which was lighted. It was such an owly black night with the wind howling that I decided to land at the old CAA strip in preference to the 900 foot strip in our backyard. Anyway, I was met there by the pilot of the plane that had crashed on the fishing trip, and he said he needed some help. So I said, all right, let's get a different plane and we'll take a look. So it was still black and windy with patches of fog drifting around, and real rough kind of a night. And a friend of mine and I took 3 sleeping bags and some food and flew up the Talkeetna River. And lo and behold, on a tiny sandbar in the middle of the river is the proprietor of the City Hotel of Fairbanks waving her clothes at us. It's a startling sight on a murky black night, a wild, violent, windy type of night. And so we dropped, made 3 passes and dropped the 3 sleeping bags and the food. And then I went back to Talkeetna and we changed into our float plane about 2 hours later. Actually, it was too dark to negotiate the swift waters right at that particular time. As we pull up to the sandbar in the float plane, now this is in the center of a fork of the river, and it's pretty wild water, it's white water, and it's a precarious position. However, I pulled up to the sandbar, and the lady said, "Say, am I glad to see you?" By this time, she had one of the sleeping bags draped over her shoulders, and she was more or less covered. We loaded her into the plane, returned to Talkeetna, and the old Fairview had a subject of discretion in landing in various places, the sandbars, the glaciers, the high altitude lakes. We covered a number of things, specifically weather, the weather type accident, which accounts for more than 80% of the calamities in Alaska and also elsewhere. And the problem of pilot error, which deals directly with discretion. Now, we talked about aircraft performance, and we covered everything from density altitude to downwind takeoffs, to overloaded aircraft, to temperature changes in squirrely air as they affect the aircraft on landing or takeoff. We get into a different area here. One of structural failure in the air. There is another area which is fire in the air, which is equally as bad. On one occasion, I experienced a structural failure in the air en route from the village of Talkeetna, which is 76 air miles north of Anchorage, in an empty aircraft, luckily, inbound to Anchorage. 20 miles north of Anchorage, run into tremendous turbulence, and I throttled the engine back. It's a single engine light four passenger aircraft, and there was tremendous up and down drafts and violent turbulence. There was a startling ripping noise at my left elbow, accompanied almost immediately by a tendency of the aircraft to turn to the left. And out of the corner of my eye, I noticed a change in the trailing edge of the wing structure. And the noise continued, the rate of turn to the left increased, and I was aware that the rear spar of the wing, now each wing in this particular aircraft has two spars, a front and a rear spar. The rear spar had pulled loose from its fitting in a violent turbulence, and the wing was slowly but surely folding rearward towards the fuselage. It progressed probably 4 or 5 inches on the on its retraction towards the fuselage. The spar seemed to lift above the fuselage, that's the rear spar, and the wing, since it had no rear support, was trying to fold backwards. All that held it was the two struts that support the wing from the bottom, attached to the bottom of the fuselage, going to the outboard bay of the wing, approximately 10 feet in from the tip of the wing. And in this configuration, the left wing was raised at the trailing edge. The right wing maintained its positive angle of attack and generated more lift, of course, than the left wing, which was tipped up at the trailing edge. The trailing edge, shortly thereafter, began a journey towards the fuselage. The wing folded back several feet, accompanied by structural failure type sounds, And I found that the only way to hold the aircraft straight was to point it straight down. And since I was only 2,000 feet in the air when the failure occurred, this didn't leave much time. I tried pointing the plane straight down, throttle clear back, in order to hopefully reduce my speed. That is, I reduced the power of the engine, pointed the plane straight down, pulled on the flaps, and this aggravated the turn. I went into a violent turn to the left. I made about three turns, losing about 1,000 feet. And I recall at the time, I had a bad cold, and I was in serious need of blowing my nose prior to the entrance of the three fast turns. Blowing the nose was not necessary because I smiled as I noticed the windshield showed evidence of my nose being having been blown on it due to the centrifugal force of the turns. And about this time I had a revelation that possibly I could raise the nose just before it crashed and make some kind of a successful landing. Now, the terrain below us was covered, below the aircraft and myself, no passengers, was covered in patches by tall spruce and much taller cottonwood trees. Some of them were 200 foot tall. My plan was, since I was nearly directly over one of these areas of high timber, to judge the rate of turn and hopefully recover and at the proper moment miss the greatest clump of trees and slide into a swamp to the west of this large group of cottonwood trees. So in about another turn and a half, I was within 400 or 500 feet of the ground, and I misjudged the turn. My rate of descent was tremendous, and as I attempted to raise the nose with the elevators, the aircraft did a series of about three snap rolls and turned and overshot my area of open swamp to the left, and rotated further to the left and into a tremendous tall patch of cottonwood trees. Now, these cottonwood trees are 4 or 5 feet on the base, the stump, and were somewhere in the neighborhood of 160 or 200 feet tall. I exploded in through the top of the trees in a tremendous, vicious snap roll gyration, and the plane stopped, hung into the tree trunks quite high in the trees, and gas poured from both wings. Both wings were now wrapped flush with the fuselage, and my ears rang from the concussion, and I was practically drowned in gas. Without any further ado, I, from my upside-down position, released my safety harness and kicked the door open and bailed out of the aircraft. And little did I know, I was 40 feet from the ground. Aircraft is hanging upside down in a very badly demolished condition in the tops of these trees. I thought possibly the aircraft had burned, but fortunately for me, it did not. I landed in the Devil Clubs and the Tag Alders and the Stumps without any serious injury, and looked back at the aircraft, and something was missing, the engine. The engine, the cowling, and the controls had been thrown about 200 feet off to the left side, and I found it in the big smoking pile in the snowbank. And so this is one more of the imponderables of flying light aircraft in Alaska or elsewhere. I had one brush with fire in the air in the 8th Air Force. We were flying a B-17 bomber. I was a crew member. And tail gun position, we were over Bremen in Germany during May of 1944. At that point in the game, nobody was sure just who would win the war of the Battle of Europe, with Germany versus Europe and Germany versus Russia also. Tremendous power at that time. Germany stood off the world and almost made it stick. At any rate, we were on a bombing run over Bremen in Flak Valley. And I mention this only from the standpoint of pointing out fire in the air. During early 1944, it was anybody's guess who would win this tremendous war, Germany versus the world, and Germans were certainly putting up an excellent account of themselves. We encountered FW-190 German aircraft, Focke-Wulf 190 with the round engine and completely armored. Pilot was well protected, the engine was well protected. The aircraft was a great performer, and the aircraft was armed with 20-millimeter cannons. Six of these FW Focke-Wulf 190 aircraft attacked our high squadron. Now, in the old days of the B-17 bombers, they flew in 312 ship elements. You had the high, which would be higher than the lead. The lead would be out front. And the low element of 12 ships each, total of 36 B-17 bombers. That was before the shooting started. Purple Heart Corner, that is the low, would be at some lower elevation, an increment of several thousand feet, and usually off to the left. The high, in other words, would be several thousand feet above the lead. The lead would be out front, making the precision radar bombing run. We had a brand of radar then. We was able to bomb through the clouds if necessary. And also, to help the other elements of the bomb run, they dropped smoke markers. And all of our aircraft are not equipped with Norden bomb sights, which was a new thing at that time, nor were they equipped with the new radar. So the point was for the lead to get out there with precision navigation, hopefully drop smoke markers on the target if it was if it was available through the clouds. If not available, smoke markers were dropped, and the next of the elements timed their turns and came in and dropped on the smoke markers as the smoke markers disappeared through the clouds. So the battery of six FW-190s peeled off, and three attacked our high element of 12 bombers from the nose, three from the tail. Now, one FW-190 came within a very few feet of us at 6 o'clock level. I did my best to stop him with twin 50 caliber machine guns. And as the distance closed, he did not catch fire, but he showed structural damage around his engine section, which was, I mentioned, heavily armored. And there was oil smoke pouring from this particular FW-190 as he dived underneath our element. However, the damage was done. His 20 millimeters had set our number one engine afire. B-17 bomber had four engines. The fire smoldered, flamed, And then a very angry flame licked the cowling of number one engine. That's the engine to the left as you sit in the aircraft. The bombers, the B-17s, had four engines. The number two engine, of course, was left inboard. Number three was right inboard. And number four was extreme right outboard. At any rate, we were on fire and shot considerably full of holes. I had a couple of 20-millimeter holes over my head, about 2 feet. The noise had been tremendous. They were timed to explode at a given interval of time, these 20 millimeters, very effective ammunition. And the pilot, Lyle, was fortunate in as much as he had a B-17G, which had some of the first fire extinguishing CO2 bottles. So he used those bottles to good advantage. He got the fire out, but the engine smoked and simmered all the way back to England after the bomb run. In addition to the number one engine being inoperational and feathered, we had other damage. We had control damage to the aircraft. Upon landing, the aircraft was demolished. We selected English Darkey Station, which is a direction-finding station in England, out of Norwich, England, and also doubled as a fighter field, a short field. And as we were about to land on our approach, we were cut out of the pattern by three English Marine Spitfire fighter planes, which took priority over one trailing B-17, obviously in trouble and trailing smoke from the number one engine. And wallowing through the air, they landed over us and ahead of us. A landing was impossible over them, as the remaining length of the field was too short. The pilot was committed. Our aircraft, fine B-17G, overshot the runway and went into the English oak trees. And there it contacted a tremendous oak tree, 8 feet on the stump, with disastrous results. The trunk of the tree wound up halfway slicing the B-17 through from the nose back through the wing sections. I mentioned fire in the air as the other possible increment of disaster in operation of aircraft. Always in expedition effort, there is rapport between the various participants, the mountaineers, the various members of the expedition. I have in mind one of Dr. Washburn's survey expeditions, which lasted through a period of 9 years. He employed a number of top flight talent during and for the survey. Now, the engineer must not also be a surveyor of the first magnitude, but he must be physically able to carry a heavy pack over sustained distances, and to also be a mountaineer. Now, to be a mountaineer covers a lot of latitude. He must have a working knowledge of rock and ice climbing. He must know what he sees. He must realize what he sees for what it is. He must see a crevasse. He must see an ice bridge. He must rationalize the picture and come up with the proper answer. As such a man was David Robin Fisher, an English engineer who was on one of the survey projects with the great Dr. Washburn at the Boston Museum of Science, and director of the Boston Museum, also director of the survey of the Alaska Range. Now, Washburn is an accomplished scientist, and he has many other hats also. He's one of the world's finest professional photographers, and he's pursued various other channels of endeavor, and he's top flight in all areas. Besides, he's a real joker, and he's not above brainwashing or psyching someone who he is in competition with. Now, in the case of some of these greatly gifted persons, they're not regular fellows. Not so in the case of Bradford Washburn. Common as an old shoe, yet as refined as a computer. It was in the Great Gorge of the Ruth Glacier that the survey had progressed to. One 10,000-foot peak remained to be used as a base station for triangulation, and also they would like to get an exact elevation from the ice at the very top of this 10,000-foot peak. So it developed that while the other members were on other projects, David Robin Fisher, the English engineer, and Brad Washburn, the director of the Boston Museum of Science, were required at this point to carry two heavy loads to the peak of the 10,000-foot mountain. In the early morning, before the other mountaineers had established themselves with waking up and breakfast and all the other incidentals, Brad Washburn made up two packs. Here's what happened. Since the top of the 10,000-foot mountain was to serve as a station for a considerable time, a considerable amount of fuel had to be carried to the summit. The great Brad Washburn took one case of Blazo, and also a considerable amount of hardware, that is, rock and ice pitons and jumars, and 250-foot ropes, which all weigh quite heavily. Total weight of the one pack was 120 pounds when very tightly compacted and lashed to a pack board. In addition to the hardware and the fuel, the complete tent and food was needed. This turned out to be a tremendous oversized pack, about 3.5 foot square. Tremendous pack. And carefully calculated as against the 120 pounds for the small compact load to be carried by one of the mountaineers. The 3.5 foot square monster pack weighed 90 pounds even, composed of tents, utensils, cooking gear, stoves, extra clothes, and some survey equipment. So, the first thing David Robin Fisher, with his analytical mind, did was weigh each pack by studied slow fashion, and he made the proper deduction that the small pack was the heavier. However, there was a doubt in his mind, and for a moment of indecision, he tried on the large pack, then tried on the small pack. But the great Brad Washburn, being the master showman that he is, convinced David Robin Fisher, the outstanding engineer that the small pack was the lighter. And so convincing was his argument that Dave and Robin Fisher packed the 120 pounds all the way to the top of the 10,000-foot mountain with Washburn needling him all the way about taking the lightest pack. Stop. Begin. I mentioned that on the original proposal for an airlift to the Alaska Range with Dr. Washburn, Boston Museum of Science, the offer, the enticement to fly the Alaska Range, land on many heretofore unnamed and unlanded on glaciers at various altitudes, the figure offered by Professor Washburn to myself was $100 a landing. Now, this in itself was practically money from heaven. I had, for a period of 3 years, I landed at elevations up to the 4,000 or 5,000 foot level every spring on the various bear hunts in the foothill glaciers of these mountains. But prior to the spring of 51, the 5,000-foot level had been my limit. I had no opportunity or no good reason to land higher, since the bears usually in the springtime broke out of their fall dens at below the 5,000-foot level. I was game and raring to go on the $100 landing. For one reason, we had 8 aircraft, fine aircraft equipped with retractable skis and floats and sandbar gear, with but a down payment on the total value of the aircraft. Here was my big chance to pay off the 8 aircraft and possibly build a suitable new hangar and offer a better service to the public. Here's what happened. After the landings progressed through 2 days, Washburn said to me, say, this is so easy. And in view of the fact that this program will last for 9 years, he said, why don't we go to 50% over your regular charter rate and go on an hourly basis rather than on a $100 landing basis? And it looked so simple. I'd made 8 or 10 landings the prior morning, and it felt like I was taking advantage of the Boston Museum, and also Washburn had mentioned that as many landings as we had to make, we might bankrupt the Boston Museum of Natural History's finance department. So I agreed to, since the project would last for 9 years, I agreed to go the route on a charter basis, an hourly rate at 50% over our base charter rate. And all went well, and throughout the 9 years of the survey, and as a matter of fact, through 21 years of high altitude operation, I had never damaged an aircraft on the Institute of Arctic Biology, the Wrangell Mountain Observatory supply runs, the passenger runs down on Mount Logan at the 10,500-foot level, on the Army Ordnance for Major Hackett, and on all the various climbs of the Alaska Range, had never damaged an aircraft. I did at one time have a structural landing gear failure, which was not serious. I was able to repair the landing gear and make a successful takeoff and go back to the village of Talkeetna for repairs. But The glacier flying properly approached in good lighting conditions with good air where the aircraft must be quite safe, because 21 years of continuous operation is a fair record without having damaged any aircraft or, more important yet, damaging any passengers.